This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the Prime Minister accused of victim blaming by the woman at the centre of a rape allegation that's embroiling the government. Also, Victoria's lockdown will end tonight, so there is relief for Melburnians preparing to resume their lives. And more concerns that the government's COVID vaccine ad campaign is not hitting the mark.
People who are coming up with the campaign need to think outside of what they normally would do, because if they want that magical herd immunity, we have to look at different groups and how those groups respond.
Brittany Higgins, the woman who has alleged she was raped in Parliament House 2 years ago, has today accused the Prime Minister of using victim-blaming rhetoric, saying the government has questions to answer about their conduct. Scott Morrison and some of his senior cabinet colleagues have faced another day of questions in Canberra about how they handled the case, an allegation of a crime carried out in a minister's office. Ms Higgins also says she only learned about key elements of her alleged assault through media reports. From Canberra, here's political reporter James Glenday.
Questions without notice, the Leader of the Opposition.
Another sitting day in the nation's capital brought another series of pointed questions about an alleged rape that's rocked Parliament House and yet again put its workplace culture in the spotlight.
Does the Prime Minister stand by his statement yesterday that his office only became aware of the rape on Friday?
I do. That's my advice, Mr Speaker. I do, Mr Speaker.
Opposition frontbenchers like Tanya Plibersek and leader Anthony Albanese say it's very hard to believe the Prime Minister only recently learned about the alleged sexual assault of former staff member Brittany Higgins, given it occurred in the ministerial wing just metres from his office in March 2019, a few weeks before the last election was called. They now want to know who knew what and when.
Brittany Higgins said that the Prime Minister's principal private secretary checked in on her. Does the Prime Minister accept Brittany Higgins' account?
Scott Morrison has previously said he's pretty sure no one in his office made contact with Ms Higgins last year, but phone records will be checked by public servants to make sure.
And I've engaged with the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet to verify that advice.
Ms Higgins, who went public with her story on Monday, says she's learning more about her alleged assault every day. She didn't know security guards let her and her alleged rapist into the minister's office, or that they saw her multiple times in a state of undress, or that they debated calling her an ambulance, or that there has for some time been an internal review into how the matter was handled.
When did the minister become aware and who told her?
In the Senate, Defence Minister Linda Reynolds, who was Ms Higgins' boss at the time of the alleged assault, was again repeatedly accused by her opponents of trying to sweep the incident under the rug.
Prime Minister yesterday announced that these matters would be thoroughly examined, and I welcome and I will support that process.
And Michaelia Cash, who until recently employed Ms Higgins in her office, became emotional when asked about how she found out about the incident.
In October 2019, a journalist made a media inquiry that involved Brittany and her previous employment. When Brittany discussed this matter with my Chief of Staff and I, she made it very clear that the matter had been dealt with at the time 7 months previously. She did not want to discuss the matter, and she did not want the matter taken any further. Her focus was on her distress at the journalist's inquiry and ensuring that at all times her own privacy was respected. We respected her wishes for privacy. But I made it very clear to her, if she needed anything, she could always come to us.
Ms Higgins, however, didn't feel that offer of support or help was genuine and was worried there would be major career consequences if she pursued formal charges. She says former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is the only senior Liberal to have phoned her in recent days, and after question time, Ms Higgins released a statement. She's deeply unhappy with some of the comments from the Morrison government and said,
"The continued victim-blaming rhetoric by the Prime Minister is personally very distressing to me and countless other survivors."
As is often the case when ministers are under pressure, colleagues in Canberra see a case for advancement. There are plenty of people in the coalition who were already less than impressed with the performance of the Defence Minister, and some believe Linda Reynolds' handling of this incident is another example of why she should be moved from her job. However, there's no sign of that happening yet.
James Glenday with that report. And if these issues raise questions for you or anyone you know, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Well, Victoria's short, sharp circuit breaker lockdown will end in just a few hours after no new cases were recorded overnight and a record 39,000 people turned out for COVID tests in the state yesterday. The tough stay-at-home restrictions imposed on more than 6 million Victorians will be wound back at midnight and businesses and classrooms will be able to reopen. People will then be able to move around more freely, but masks will remain. The Premier concedes the lockdown has caused pain, but says it was necessary, and he won't hesitate to do it again if the health advice recommends it. From Melbourne, Emily Burke reports.
From midnight, Victorians won't need a reason to be out and about, and they'll be able to travel more than 5 kilometres from home. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, says the Holiday Inn cluster has been effectively contained.
40,000 tests almost, zero cases. That was the desired outcome. The fact that we've not seen this run wild, I'd hardly take that as a criticism. I think that's a credit to the people of Victoria and the fact that they know this is not over.
Priscilla is in the northern suburb of Strathmore. She's a teacher and has 4 primary school children herself.
I haven't been the greatest mum, I suppose. I don't like a lot of technology in the house normally, but when you've got to work at home, you've got to do it. So unfortunately, you know, the TV and the iPads have been used.
And school goes back tomorrow, so how do you feel about that?
The good. They need some routine. We kind of just got them back into it. The youngest, she's in grade 1. Last year was a debacle for her, and she doesn't really know what school is yet.
Ali and Julia are heading back to the classroom tomorrow.
It's been good, but it's been hard because, like, when our parents are working, you know, we have to do school by ourselves, and we don't have anyone, you know, to help us.
Yeah.
We just got back in January and then we had to stop again, so just stop and start. That's why I'm really excited to go back.
I think it's good news though. At least we got to see more people out of sea, which is a very positive sign to me, so can't wait.
Jack runs a fish and chip shop and has one word to describe the last 5 days.
Sucks.
It sucks?
Sucks,
yeah.
It's completely dead. The first time lockdown last year, it wasn't bad as this time. So it's make everybody suffering, small business, big business, individual, all the families. It's make a huge impact.
It's the same at the kebab and grill house just up the road.
Usually the schools are in here, it's about 5-6 schools. That is gone. There's no tradies. So we're really depending on the locals.
The lockdown lifts at midnight.
Hopefully everything goes back to normal.
Has it been hard mentally?
It has been. You're just thinking, am I going to make it through today in terms of wages instead of staff? Is it, am I going to waste all this food that I cooked it? It's just constantly thinking, is it going to be a good day or a bad day?
But tomorrow will be a good day for Jake, who runs a cafe.
Knowing that we can sort of start prepping for tomorrow is nice as well. Getting everything ready and then having everyone sit down and, yeah.
How's your confidence about being able to stay open, given that the Premier says he won't hesitate to do another lockdown if that's what the advice says?
Yeah, the back and forth hurts a lot. Like, changing from full dine-in to takeaway at a drop of a hat is sort of a little bit tough, but still very excited to be back into normal.
Part of that normal means that home visits are back, but capped at 5 people. And people can return to their workplaces, but with limits. Funerals and weddings can go ahead with density limits, but masks are still required both indoors and outside where social distancing isn't possible. A further relaxation of the rules is expected Friday week. In regional Victoria, many are still questioning whether they really needed to be included in the lockdown. David Strange owns the Meetung pub in Gippsland.
Probably if metropolitan Melbourne was locked down, I would agree with him, but I just can't see why Gippsland and other areas that are 350 kilometres away need to suffer too.
This is a deeply emotional thing. There is pain, there is hurt. I understand that. But it's not over. We've got one pallet of vaccines turned up. That's great news. But we haven't got any in anyone's arms yet.
Premier Andrews says the scale of the lockdown was justified.
In this outbreak, we've had 66 close contacts for every case. We've got 3,500 people that have been at places or in the company of people who are either positive or might well turn positive in the balance of these 14 days. Ultimately, when you're getting to cases and they've already infected the people they live with, the sheer number of people that those people have interacted with and the people that their contacts have interacted with, that's where you've got to add a fourth ring, and that is, regrettably, and with full acknowledgement of the challenges and the pain that it causes, there's no alternative but to take these steps.
A decision on when international flights can arrive in Melbourne is yet to be made.
Emily Burke with that report. Well, COVID cases and deaths globally are falling as vaccines are rolled out, and the first will be administered in Australia within days. The federal government also rolled out a $24 million advertising campaign late last year to convince people the drugs are safe and effective. The ads are based around presenting facts using the health experts we've become familiar with over this year of the pandemic. But could something more emotional, with more of a story, even something evoking celebrity work, be more effective to bring on board those who are still wondering about the vaccines? Isabel Rowe reports.
COVID-19 has changed our lives. For us to live more freely, we need the added protection of COVID-19 vaccines.
Dressed in a white lab coat with a stethoscope around his neck, infectious disease physician Dr. Nick Coatsworth delivers the basics about the vaccine in this government-funded TV ad.
The rollout of the vaccines will be available in batches.
The government's education campaign includes information about where you can get the vaccine and how it was developed so quickly. But for many people, that won't be enough. Dr. Margie Rogers from the University of New England is an expert on health messaging.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the campaign, but I think we could go a little bit further and we could have some health narratives added into that.
Dr. Rogers studies the impact of emotion on people's decisions, particularly when it comes to making decisions about immunisation. She thinks using real-life accounts from people affected by coronavirus is a better way to sell the vaccine.
Somebody who's had either experience with the disease themselves, they have had a disease such as coronavirus, and these are the long-term effects, or this is how I was when I had this disease. The challenge is that we don't have those narratives in the community very much, because most of us don't know someone who has been on the front line.
In the UK, the National Health Service has taken a more creative approach.
My name is Elton John.
It's used celebrities and humour to spruik the vaccine as safe.
And as you can see, I'm still standing. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Thanks, Elton.
Dr. Margie Rogers thinks the celebrity method could win over the small group of people who would usually always get a vaccine but are sceptical this time.
So normally we have groups of people that will just go and get the vaccine because they're pro-vaccination, and this is just what's a cultural norm and this is what we do. But it may be that there are groups that would normally have it that are just a little bit hesitant this time. You know, we're in an age of influencers on social media, and so the people who are coming up with the campaign need to think outside of what they normally would do.
A government-run survey released this week reveals 64% of Australians will definitely get a COVID vaccine, while 27% are unsure and could wait a while before getting theirs. 9% say they have no intention of getting the vaccine at all. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Paul Kelly says they are some worrying numbers.
Please, when your turn comes, line up and get it, because these vaccines will save lives.
Australia's drug regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, has now approved Pfizer and AstraZeneca's vaccines for use. But many pregnant women still have questions about what vaccine is safe for them. Jo Di Parizot is one of those people. She's from France but living in Sydney and won't rush to get the vaccine while she's in her third trimester.
In Australia, the situation is very good compared to the rest of, like most of the rest of the world. I don't feel an emergency to do it while I'm pregnant. If I was in a country with like a high number of cases every day, and if I was in my early pregnancy, I would consider it, yeah.
Perhaps if it's in a couple of months or later this year, do you think you'll take it then?
Yes, I think so, because we all want to be able to travel again. But I hope that being vaccinated will enable us to not only leave Australia but enter the country we want to go to.
The World Health Organization is advising pregnant women not to get the Pfizer vaccine until more studies are done, but says the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe to take while pregnant, particularly if the person is also a frontline health worker.
Isabel Rowe and PM has contacted the Health Minister Greg Hunt's office for a response on that story. You're listening to PM on the radio, the ABC Listen app and the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, calls for more government investment in a domestic space launch capability. Well, Donald Trump dramatically broke his relative silence today to restake his claim to the soul of his party against the second most powerful Republican, Senator Mitch McConnell. Mr. McConnell has been a long-time ally of Mr. Trump, delivering him repeated victories, including acquittal just days ago on charges of inciting insurrection on the 6th of January at the Capitol. But in a 600-word statement, Mr. Trump has now excoriated McConnell, calling him an unsmiling political hack and warning the party would not win if he remained in charge. Dr. David Smith from the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney says it's a direct response to McConnell's stance immediately after the trial.
McConnell voted against convicting Trump, but he also made a pretty savage statement, really holding him responsible for the Capitol riot and suggesting that Trump shouldn't be the future of the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell is the most powerful figure in the Republican Party behind Trump himself. And Trump feels that this just can't go unanswered. The future could really be something of a power struggle between Trump and McConnell. And Trump really feels that McConnell has betrayed him. This is despite the fact McConnell has pretty faithfully helped Trump right throughout his career. He now feels that the Republican Party has to split from Trump. And this statement from Trump indicates Trump doesn't want to go away.
I mean, it is quite extraordinary. Trump says in the statement that McConnell lacks political insight, wisdom and skill. I mean, if this is a battle between the two men, surely nobody in the Republican Party is going to believe that sort of line.
Well, at the moment, the vast majority of the Republican base will side with Trump over McConnell. Now, Trump has described anybody who acknowledges that Joe Biden won the election as weak and as a bad politician. Opinion polls keep showing that the majority of Republicans think there was widespread election fraud. And some polls show a majority of Republicans saying that Joe Biden didn't rightfully win the election. This is shaped up as a real dividing line in the Republican Party between this very pro-Trump base and then between people in Congress and donors and in the media who want the Republican Party to move on from Trump. But at the grassroots level, where state party organizations have the power to censure Republican members of Congress, where primary challenges are going to arise to Republican members of Congress, Trump still has all of the power there.
It's perfectly obvious that Trump has lost for the Republican Party the full suite of federal power in America, the House, the Senate and the presidency. Do you think he will fade from influence inevitably as people reassess that reality and he's not just not there in their faces every day?
I think it's very hard to tell and it's very hard to predict whether he's going to fade. Certainly, I think that some things have changed and one of the things that's changed is the social media ban. But certainly immediately, yes, you would think, having been the first president since 1932 to oversee the loss of the White House and both houses of Congress, you would think that some of the shine would be taken off Trump. But we have to remember, once again, the majority of Republicans don't believe that he lost. So unlike in 2012, when there was an autopsy of the defeat, there isn't going to be an autopsy of the defeat. Even the majority of Republican members of Congress have really acquiesced to this stolen election myth. So he may fade in time, and certainly that handful of Republicans who voted for impeachment will be hoping that he fades, but there's no sign of it happening immediately.
And I guess there's also the reality is that America's political cycle is just relentless, isn't it? And so everybody's going to be peddling right now, aren't they, to position themselves for that.
Yes, and it's also worth remembering that despite the fact that Joe Biden got the highest share of any challenger to the presidency since 1932, beat Trump by 7 million votes, because of the way that the Electoral College works, Republicans actually came within 40,000 votes of winning the presidency. They came within 90,000 votes of winning the presidency and both houses of Congress. So those Republicans who actually do acknowledge that Trump lost, nonetheless, they're not in a state of despair about the future of the party. They believe that they are very close to coming back to power.
So hang on for more chapters in the McConnell-Trump battle, I suppose.
Yes.
David Smith, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Smith from the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. Well, the world has spent the last 14 months locked in a fight against COVID-19, but infectious diseases experts are simultaneously battling another terrifying illness. Ebola outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Guinea have forced the World Health Organization to launch a new vaccination campaign in Central and parts of West Africa. Health officials say they're relying on two key weapons, science and public trust. David Sparks has more.
Two separate outbreaks, more than 4,000 kilometres apart, have global authorities worried. One is in southeastern Guinea, where at least 7 cases have been confirmed. The other is in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where 4 cases have been confirmed less than a year after another outbreak ended. These countries have grim memories of previous Ebola outbreaks. The deadliest in history tore through West Africa between 2013 and 2016, killing 11,000 people, mostly in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The next deadliest outbreak was in DRC, ending last year. Canberra-based epidemiologist Dr. Chatu Yapa was on the ground fighting the virus in Liberia with Médecins Sans Frontières in 2014.
So Ebola outbreaks, when they start, can seem very daunting because there's so much to do at any one time. And, you know, it's kind of a race against time to set up Ebola isolation centres, because the priority is really trying to track and trace anyone who's unwell, to get them to have an Ebola test, and then anyone who's positive to be isolated, and then to contact trace their close contacts. Of course, then that has to be weighed up with engaging with the community, because we've learnt over time that that is a crucial aspect of the Ebola response.
A vaccination effort began in Democratic Republic of Congo on Monday, and Guinea is preparing to launch its own campaign. The WHO has begun genetic sequencing of new samples of the virus to figure out whether they result from human transmission or from new animal-to-human transmissions. Dr. Ian Norton is founder of Respond Global. He worked with the WHO in a number of countries during the major outbreak of 2013-16 and in the more recent outbreak in DRC.
I'm particularly worried about the Guinea outbreak because of our history there in 2014 and 15. I'm less concerned in DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, because they have had multiple recent outbreaks. This is in an area in the Kivus where we have been fighting Ebola for about 2 years. It's still well contained, and there's a lot of people who are still in place and can actually manage and respond, whereas in Guinea, it's been many years since there was the last Ebola outbreak.
He's been involved in previous Ebola vaccination campaigns, and he says, like the COVID Pfizer vaccine, this one needs to be kept super cool at minus 70 degrees Celsius.
It's a lot of logistics and a lot of work to get that done, but I think we can be confident that should be in place. And we use a ring vaccine approach, whereby we find the initial case, their family, their local contacts, and then we also vaccinate the contacts of the contacts, so the next ring out. So all of those people receive a vaccine immediately in the field, as do health workers working in the treatment centres.
Professor Alexandra Cromick from the Australian Infectious Diseases Research Centre has worked in the development of Ebola vaccines. He says despite 2 decades of research, the real push to develop Ebola vaccines didn't gather pace until the outbreak of 2013.
In the subsequent outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2018 and also in 2020, there were a lot more people vaccinated using this vaccine. And the efficacy of vaccine, as I said already, is 100%. So it's a matter of immunizing people in the right locations in the right time to prevent the further spread.
Professor Alexander Cromick from the Australian Infectious Diseases Research Centre. David Sparks, our reporter there. Well, Australia claims to be making great strides in the space race, despite being late to the game. But Australian companies say they are forced to rely on overseas investors because there's not enough interest here. There are also calls for government investment in domestic launch capabilities so Australian technology can be tested in space from Australian territory. The government agency responsible for the space industry was quizzed on its progress in parliamentary hearings today. Mario Christodoulou reports.
It's the dead of night, and on a dusty plain in southeast Queensland near Toowoomba, a machine is rumbling to life. It's a rocket thruster. It stutters and then fires up, igniting and lighting up the ground with a blazing white flame which stretches for metres. These are the beginnings of Australia's space industry. But impressive as this is, in the global space race, Australia isn't even close to the front of the pack. The global space economy is worth an estimated $540 billion and is forecasted to grow to over $1.4 trillion in 20 years. But Australia contributes only around 1% to that. Today, the Parliament's Standing Committee on Innovation and Science heard that Australia's space capability is growing. Anthony Murphy, Deputy Head of the Australian Space Agency, told the hearing technology is making it cheaper and easier to reach the stars.
We've moved from the 1960s and the big Saturn V rockets. We're in a place where the technology is smaller. We're able to do innovation cycles a lot quicker.
Around 2.5 years ago, the government announced its civil space strategy aimed at tripling the size of the industry from $4 billion to $12 billion. And so far, Australia's capabilities, the inquiry heard today, has begun to attract international attention.
NASA comes to Australia and they can't believe what we can do with those big yellow trucks up in the Pilbara. They don't have that level of automation, and that's why Australia is at the table looking at these opportunities.
But the business of putting satellites into space isn't cheap. Many Australian businesses rely on overseas investment, which calls for the government to do more to help. Adam Gilmore is the chief executive of Gilmore Space, an Australian company which makes rockets.
The technology in space takes time and money to develop, and if the government can provide funding to get technology up to a level that is qualified for space, that allows Australian companies to then compete in the global space supply chain.
He says the importance of having a local space industry has grown and is now an issue of national sovereignty.
I mean, the reality is we rely on other countries' satellites right now for a tremendous amount of things that we do and we don't even think about. And so people just don't realise how much they use space, and they don't realise that they're relying on the assets, satellites and the rockets of other countries to do it.
Mark Skidmore is Executive Director of Skycraft, a startup that develops satellites. He says his company is reliant on money from investors, and most of the big money is overseas.
You know, I want to see companies like ours stay sovereign as well, so we can provide the Australian people with the opportunity to grow and develop and control a space services company.
One of the major obstacles he faces is testing his technology, or in other words, getting it into space. Quite simply, it costs a lot of money.
One of the concepts or ideas that we had was around, rather than just providing grants or money, actually fund launches and letting small companies get their systems onto that launch. So a ride share on a launch.
The Australian Space Agency is starting to take the first tentative steps towards constructing this sort of infrastructure, building a mission control in South Australia and a tracking facility in Tasmania. One particular motivation in Australia is the rapid militarisation of space in other countries. Just last month, the new US Secretary of Defence, Lloyd J. Austin, a retired four-star Army general, referred to space as a warfighting domain, describing rival superpower China as a significant threat. Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce is the chair of the committee. He wants the intellectual property behind Australian advancements to remain here because he says keeping an edge over rivals like China is vital to our national security.
It is absolutely vital in a modern defence platform that we have competent and advanced space technology.
Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce, Mario Christodoulou with that report. I'm Linda Mottram, and that is PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Donald Trump may have been acquitted in his Senate impeachment trial at the weekend, but the former president's troubles are a long way from over.
Today on The Signal, with possible charges against him ranging from sedition to tax fraud, is Donald Trump going to go down? And if he does, could he still run again anyway?
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.